40 years of work, 1 year of to beat all of it. That's where Samsung's chip division, not Doritos, finds itself in 2026. More profitable this year alone than in its entire four-decade history. Not Apple, not NVIDIA, not Microsoft. Yes, South Korea's own Samsung, because AI needs memory. Well, that would be NVIDIA. A lot of it in Samsung makes memory. And when memory is this scarce, I can't talk right now. This in demand, everything with a chip inside it gets more expensive. Your phone, your laptop, your next upgrade, if you can actually afford it. The AI race has a winner nobody saw coming, and the ripple effects are just only starting to hit. This is a tech hangout, and let's get into it. Well, I guess I should introduce our panel today.
To get into it.
We're a little bit smaller than usual. That's because a lot of our normal guests are in this little place called Chicago, well, the suburbs, for MacStock.
Yep.
Which, for some of you, that might actually interest you, because this is the only interest of Apple you will see during this show.
That's true. Don't have any Apple stories today.
Yep. So, since we are talking chips today, let me introduce making his inaugural Tech Hangouts appearance, Mr. Tom.
Major Tom.
Hi, Ben. Major Tom. I did bring the Doritos. So we can talk about chips today.
Yeah, those are already expensive.
Yeah, they are. I haven't bought them in a long time. I'm like, holy crap. You know, I used to buy them for like 35 cents. You know?
And so when it's $35.
Yeah, it's $2.99. Yeah, it's $2.99. You get about six chips. Anyway, I'm very excited to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
And I'd also like to introduce our founder, Patrice.
Yeah, hi.
Yes. Yeah, we should just get, like, hired Jeffrey Combs to just come in and say, founder.
Oh, that would be funny. I would do that. That would be cool. Yes. The founders. Okay. We're the founders, yes. There's a great link. Wait a second. There's a great link as well, which is thetechhangout.com.
Question is, do you have a succession plan?
No.
We don't have a plan for 5 minutes into the show. What are you talking
exactly.
about?
Exactly.
Okay, I lied. We do have some stories today.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to call an audible here. And Tom, give us those Doritos, because we're going to be talking chips.
All right. I go first. The new guy goes first. So the story is Samsung announced results for the quarter. The way they do it in Korea, they kind of pre-announce. It's a little bit weird. I don't quite understand it. But the bottom line is Samsung announced results of dollars, $58.5 billion for the quarter a couple of days ago. $58 billion for the quarter.
For one quarter.
And now the one quarter profit. This is profit, not revenue. It's profit. It's crazy. So what is that? $20 billion a month? Go ahead.
Let me clarify one thing. This isn't all of Samsung. This is Samsung Electronic Device Solutions.
Right. So it's a semiconductor division which covers both logic and memory devices. Mm-hmm. And the memory side is especially now much bigger. They do, you know, foundry and for logic devices, for processors and things. And they're getting better at that, but they're mostly known on the semiconductor side for memory, both DRAM and flash. So the consensus for the analyst is for the year now, for the full year of 2026, is operating profit of $196 billion. And the headline of the story is kind of the most amazing thing, that $196 billion represents more profit than Samsung Semiconductor Division has made cumulatively over the last 40 years.
Yeah, and that's no small, that's not a small division or a small company, right?
No.
Yeah, before TSMC, Samsung, this division of Samsung was Apple's primary chip partner.
Right. True. Right. They've always been pretty good at logic foundry stuff, but always a little bit behind TSMC technology wise and sort of customer service wise. They're still, you know, strong second place, but you know, TSMC is like 60% of that business worldwide. So everybody else splits up the other 40%. That's called market dominance, by the way, 60% of logic foundry business owned by TSMC. And of course, over the years, there have been many, many years where because of memory prices, you know, the ups and downs of memory prices, the Samsung division has made very little money or even lost money. So included in that 40 years is some negative numbers. But it's just astounding. We talk a lot about different ways of looking at the RAM apocalypse. You know, how much does it cost to buy, you know, 64 gig for your laptop?
Yeah.
And, you know, the fact that memory prices, street prices are, you know, 5 to 10x what they were 12 to 18 months ago.
Yeah.
And just like when oil prices go up, you know, oil prices go up and all the oil companies make tons of money.
Mm-hmm.
DRAM prices go up and all the DRAM companies make tons of
money. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's telling here that Samsung, Samsung Electronic Device Solutions made more money than NVIDIA did just selling as many Blackwell powered servers as they could.
Yeah, I mean that's the crazy thing here, right? In this AI arms race that we're in right now, or AI race in general, the AI bubble, whatever you want to call it, the AI, it's you would expect that the Anthropics, the NVIDIAs, the OpenAIs, the Microsofts of the world, that's where all the profit is because that's what's being used, right? Graphics cards and whatever. And the reality is, when you look really behind the scenes, it's companies like Samsung who are making a lot of the money because RAM prices, that's normal markets working, right? They cannot produce more. They're trying to, but it takes years to spin up new fabs. And also the question, should they? Because like, who knows whether the demand won't go back to what it was before, and then you have fabs that nobody needs. So they're basically, they're supplying all of that. And like anybody who runs local models knows RAM, VRAM is the thing. That's what you need.
Yeah, it's kind of like the gold rush. You know, Levi Strauss made more money selling denim jeans
to
gold miners than the gold miners made. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, you know, people always say, so why don't they just build more capacity? You know, because it's a supply demand problem.
Yeah.
It's the reason why the prices are going up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And of course they're building capacity.
Yes.
But it's so expensive, you know, between, $5 to $10 billion to build a new fab, and it'll take a couple of years.
Yeah.
That it's not.
Or
so
10
much
to 20 right now. Because other stuff like with Iran and everything, like there's also cost increases that are outside of the chip business.
Yeah. Right. And it's not only the fact that you have to spend $5, $10, $20 billion to build a fab, but by the time you build it and it's up and running, this demand may go away or flatten out. And then they'll be sitting on a $10 billion fab that's not producing anything. Yeah. And that can kill a company.
Yes.
Yeah. They have to be very careful.
Tom, you go first.
Yeah. So they have to be very careful. I think it was Ben is going to say about forecasting and planning for expansion. They they've been burned many, many, many times over the years over building.
Yeah. Yeah. And,
by the way, it doesn't end with GPUs and CPUs and memory prices going up. Guess what? You probably already know networking chips got more expensive because you need those in data centers.
Yep.
Power management ICs that use, you know, really old manufacturing technology, they're starting to become in short supply. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it's like it's the whole thing, right? At the end of the day, like you're not just installing GPUs or RAM. Like there's a whole machine around that also is needed, and a whole data center around that also needs to be built and so on.
Right.
So it has ripple effects.
Yep, and I don't like to get into politics, but around here there is a lot of discussion because. People are trying to build data centers pretty much everywhere to meet usage demands.
Yeah. And I think that is the part we're already seeing it's slowing down. I mean, slowing down, the increase is slowing down. It's not that it's like, okay, people aren't so crazy like usage-wise, but you definitely see as prices are increasing also for the AI models or for the AI usage because it's now being less subsidized, right? A lot of it was, I mean, the $10-$20 a month, and you could basically do what you already wanted with the biggest models that you could get. That's over. Big companies like Microsoft are switching from, I mean, like a year ago, even the idea, or even beginning of this year, the idea was token maxing. So use as many tokens as you can. And now they're going the opposite direction, saying, okay, let's use as few tokens as we can, because it's just getting too expensive to do so. And it's also, to be honest, usually not very effective to do so. So like the Microsoft, I think, just announced that they're for their development, for the internal stuff, they're going to their own models now and doing their own things. I think you're seeing that the market is also, the AI market is slowing down. So the question is not, is AI going anywhere? It's not. The question is not, are we going to go back to like where we were? We're definitely not. The question is just what is the level that we're settling on, right? Like how much RAM per year do we need, basically? Or how many, like chips in general, and that's what is the new normal load that we have to produce.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, we're in a ramp up period. It's determining when that ramp up ends and levels out to a new normal.
Yeah, and I mean, we've seen that the companies in that race right now. It used to be like tech companies to go to like a multi-billion-dollar exit, like an IPO, whatever. You would take 4 or 5 years. If they ever got there, but like a lot of them, like the successful ones would take a couple of years until they IPO'd. We're seeing 12 to 16 months or something, 12 to 18 months, something like that. If you're lucky, sometimes it might even be 6 months or something. So that's how fast this is right now going. Like, I mean, Anthropic as a company didn't exist a couple of years ago. And they IPO'd, and same for the SpaceX, whatever it's now called, IPO. Same thing.
SpaceX AI.
Yeah, I mean SpaceX existed for a while, but XAI didn't. Mm-hmm. Like, say OpenAI, same thing. Like those companies haven't been around for that long, and they're already massive IPOs.
Netscape, anybody? Same idea. I think the one thing, one of the big winners of the Samsung profit boom mm-hmm. are the workers. You might remember a couple of months ago, there was this concern that the Samsung semiconductor workers were going to go on strike.
Yeah.
And they ended up making a settlement. And part of the settlement is they negotiated a percentage of the profits that will go to the workers.
Nice.
And the numbers are insane. It's like yeah. hundreds of thousands of dollars per employee based yeah. on the projections of profit.
I mean, but I also think that's how it should be, right? Right. They are part. They're part of the success. they're contributing to it, in whatever small way, but in some a lot because they're doing the work. They should benefit yeah. from it. It shouldn't just be the owners of the company and the investors in the company.
Yep. Then when all the boom ends, all Samsung's workforce will retire.
No, yeah, they have to pay money back.
Yeah, yeah. No, but I mean that usually doesn't happen. People, I mean, some people do retire, but like usually people just want to work. They want to do something with their lives, basically.
Yeah. Okay. Not me. I retired. You work fine.
Yeah, but you worked for a long time before you did that.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
Yep, and speaking of AI and LLMs, Patrice, tell us about OpenAI screwing up.
Yes, so there's been a lawsuit for the last 3 years, I think, late 2023 when it was filed, where the New York Times sued OpenAI and Microsoft, who owned part of OpenAI, accusing them of training ChatGPT on millions of copyrighted articles without permission. That whole thing has since grown to a coalition of 17 news organizations, for example, also the New York Daily News and many others, and has been ongoing. Like, you know how those lawsuits, big companies suing each other, like how that goes, a lot of lawyers, mm-hmm. whatever. But turns out OpenAI screwed up because they claimed previously that that they couldn't search their own ChatGPT output logs, and they couldn't figure out if there was copyrighted material in there and all of that. And then the OpenAI privacy engineer, Vincent Monaco, was redeposed, and he inadvertently admitted that OpenAI had already searched his own ChatGPT output logs internally. And whoops. Turns out that the 2 years while they were telling everybody that they can't do it, they were actually doing it. So it turns out OpenAI possesses a de-identified sample of 78 million ChatGPT conversations and a 10 million sample, so they can actually identify things, never disclosed. Despite the fact that they should have. They had already searched those logs for New York Times content to build their own copyright filter, and then claimed that they couldn't do such a search. They gave the New York Times or the group behind it like a 20 million access to a restricted sandbox of 20 million instead of the full set that they had. 120 million were requested, and said, oh, we can't do that. Made 19 billion redactions to the small sample, wow. the 10 million sample, so that the court itself called it unusable. So, and also deleted and or compressed billions of logs that they were supposed to preserve. And one witness apparently said they simply decided it would be hard to comply, so they just didn't. So the New York Times and the group behind it are asking for severe sanctions, specifically barring OpenAI from using the 20 million log sample as evidence, because that's useless. A court finding that OpenAI's logs contained substantial regurgitation of their copyrighted content, so basically admitting that they've done it, and a jury instruction that OpenAI deleted billions of logs, basically is telling the jury to draw negative consequences or inferences out of that. Of course, OpenAI is pushing back. We'll see. They're saying, oh, privacy, we can't invade the privacy of people, blah, 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 all of that. And still, of course, they're still claiming, oh, this is all fair use and, oh, like, you know, all of that. So I don't know, like, Ben, like, you've worked in media in the past. Like, what are your thoughts about this?
Sam Altman, I would start getting that check ready.
Yeah. I mean, that is a pretty big screw up.
Yeah. Right now, the only thing that is between OpenAI and paying out a ton of money is mm-hmm. potential the ruling on fair use.
Yeah. Because yeah, I mean, that's their whole defense. Yeah, I mean, that's the whole defense of OpenAI and, to be honest, a lot of the other companies. They're saying, oh, yeah, you know, it's all the internet, so it's all fair use. We can just take whatever we want.
Which is the same argument that the companies that are using OpenAI models to train their own stuff. It's all fair use.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, sure. I would probably argue the same way because it would be like, hey, I can take data for free. So of course, whether it's legal or not is a complete question.
OpenAI took data for free. Why can't I take OpenAI?
Exactly. Yeah. Why can't I take the OpenAI model for free?
Yeah, and here's the thing about LLMs. They were basically in service before the legal question surrounding them was ever settled.
Yeah.
So we're either going to find out that, yeah, this is perfectly okay and everything can operate as normal.
Yeah.
Or there's going to be some giant royalty checks paid out by not only AI, but all the other, but Google and Anthropic as well.
Yeah.
That's a legal precedent.
Yeah. I mean, Anthropic is claiming that all their content is not, but whether that's true or not is a different question.
Well, in this, and I mean, the details are messy, but
yes,
there's also, you know, if I have a blog that I post on the web, not behind a paywall, I'm not sure I have much to complain about. But
even if it was not behind the paywall, there is, I mean, technically you still own the content. And it's still copyrighted, right? And you might not care and say, yeah, whatever, take it. I don't care. But if you're a news organization that makes their money and has a business and has employees that are getting paid and all of that, is a professional organization, I think the argument changes slightly, at least. That's it. Technically, even your blog is copyrighted.
Right. Yeah,
I mean, unless you release it.
Yeah. But
you can't.
None of that, but media companies are for-profit companies. Some of them are some of which are public.
Yes.
For any public entity that has shareholders, mm-hmm. it is their fiduciary responsibility to find every revenue source they can.
Yeah.
If this is a revenue source, it is in their interest to find a way to get that money.
I mean, I'm going to push back on that. I don't like that argument of, oh, this is, you're basically, you have to extort any amount of money from everything because you're a public company. No, the company, even any company, but especially a public company has usually keep being a company and keep doing their business and keep paying people, right? Because otherwise they're not a company.
Yeah.
So you might not have to make every dollar you can, but you have to make enough that you are a company.
Yeah, the logical ending to the OpenAI argument is there will be no journalists or creatives.
Yeah. Who needs them?
There'll be no money to pay the journalists and creatives. You got to pay them. You know, you got to pay people.
I mean, and coming from that world and knowing how much that revenue is advertising based, there is definitely an element of truth there.
Yeah.
Yeah. If everybody's getting everything through ChatGPT and all the information in ChatGPT is taken from people who did hard work to create that content, the end result is a dystopia I don't want to be a part of.
I mean, at the end of the day, they're saying the work of the journalist is worth nothing.
Right.
We can take it. We can do whatever we want with it. It's worth nothing. And we can sell it however we want. Right? That's at the end of the day, that's the argument behind it. And I think a lot of people would disagree with that and say you can argue about how much it's worth and depends maybe on the article and the journalist and the journal and whatever, but there's hard work that went into it.
I wonder if the music industry is any kind of model or lesson. You know, we went from physical media to streaming with music, and there was a lot of back and forth about how you actually pay the musicians.
Yeah.
And we've settled in a place where they get paid. They just get paid a lot less than they used to get paid.
And these days, even less with AI music.
Right.
Again, same problem.
Which, by the way, is why your favorite band is pushing merch and VIP packages.
Yep.
Because that's how they get money. Because, Mercury, Geffen, and all those other big record companies, they're not throwing around money like they used to.
No. They used to tour to promote albums. Now they get now they tour to get paid.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. We'll see how this trial ends. I have for sure a preferred outcome. We'll see what the effect is. I mean, in fact, it's too late, right? The models have been trained. I don't think you can undo that. So probably a big check, and in this case, probably a very, very, very big check that would have to be paid. Because, I mean, just look at what AI companies are making right now.
Right.
So we'll see.
Yep. We shall see. So our last story today is going to be kind of a fun one for a very surprising vehicle with some very surprising specs that I don't think would ever be sold in America.
No.
Yep. It is the Fiat, and I apologize to any Italians if I pronounce this completely wrong, Topolino.
Topolino. Yeah.
Yes. It is a little 8-horsepower EV
little
that is very cutesy.
Yeah.
That, do you want to know when we will see this on our roads?
Never.
Exactly. Well, there's an asterisk to that. The standard Topolino is not road legal.
Right.
Basically, it is classified as a pseudo golf cart.
Right.
Huh. Interesting.
Yep. Yeah. There is also a optional future conversion kit that will allow it to be road legal, but only as a low speed vehicle.
Yeah.
Right.
Which are quite popular. Yeah, but quite popular in like a lot of bigger cities. Because it's like, or Florida. Yeah. No, but it's like even like here, I see Hawaii. Like small cars, like every, like not a lot, but there is some people that are definitely into it. It's like, why drive a big car when it's just you and you're just going from A to B? Like,
yeah, definitely. In certain use cases, they're ideal. You see them all over Hawaii, people that live in Hawaii.
Yeah.
And, they live on an island. And most of the
there's one highway, and it's like, can go around the island in like an hour.
Yeah.
And the weather's good,
Yeah, true.
It's no winter. You're seeing a lot of, especially in more rural communities, UTVs and ATVs.
Yeah.
Laws being passed to allow them on roads.
Mm-hmm.
So there is definitely a market for a commuter vehicle. This is definitely one of a kind. Well, I wouldn't say one of a kind. There are a lot of Chinese imported ones similar to this.
The German smart car is kind of like
smart
that.
Car,
maybe a little bit bigger nowadays, but
this is really the first automobile in this class from an actual legitimate automaker. That we would know of.
electric vehicle for sure.
Yeah, I mean, it's. I mean, Fiat has a history, though, right? They have the 500, which is the bigger version, but not that much bigger version of that.
Not much bigger.
Yeah.
With a gas engine.
Well, no, they have electric versions.
It's electric.
There's an electric Fiat 500e. Like they have a history, and I think it's a very Italian thing. I mean, they have sometimes those little streets where it's like, I mean, it's hard to drive a bigger car. So like a typical, like an average, the average American like car would not fit into a small like Italian like city somewhere, like street. You wouldn't be able to fit through or find parking.
Yeah, and this might actually be able to fit in the bed of an F-150.
Probably, yeah. I think so. Yeah, you could probably put it, like, pop it on your back if you're, like, you're going somewhere, like, just carry it around.
Yeah.
That's probably too heavy with the battery.
Yeah, I kind of put this in the same category as a MacBook Neo.
Yeah.
I know it does not meet my needs, but there is just something about it that makes me want it just because.
Yeah. It's a cute little car. I mean, as I said, for just driving around in a set, like, or like the like Italian, like one of those beach towns, and just like going to the beach, going home, going to the supermarket, whatever. Like, yeah.
Well, there are so many use segments in this kind of transportation. And I think, as we said, this one fits a particular use type.
Yeah. And it's not expensive. Right.
No, and I think one of the big problems with, at least in the U.S., with vehicles in general, whether they're electric or hybrid or ICE, is they don't sell cheap small cars anymore because they don't make any money off.
Yeah,
there's no profit in selling small cars. I just wish it was a company other than Stellantis. They're not my favorite. Automobile manufacturer. I'm not sure I'd ever buy a Stellantis product.
Fiat still has kind of a stigma. The, you know how Ford has the acronym "Found on Road Dead." Fiat is fix it again, Tony.
I did it back in, what was it, 2016, maybe? 16, 17, something like that. 17, probably. I did a test drive of the back then prototype Fiat 500e, because they had, like, they did, like, a study somewhere. It was the worst car. I'm sorry, but it was really the worst car in the mix. I mean, it was a prototype, so, like, maybe it improved afterwards, and I hope it did, because, I mean, they did that for the feedback, right? But yeah, it was. But there's people that it's exactly what they want.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're not known for the highest quality, but
they're cheap. They're cheap and they work.
There are a lot of Fiat 500s around here.
Yeah.
But Stellantis, between Nissan, Fiat, Chrysler, they just don't have the brands that I'm interested in.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
even though they have the best CEO scandal story in history, Carlos, whatever his name is, that guy.
The guy that's like still on the run.
But at least somebody's trying to make cheap small electric vehicles. I mean, it gets 30-40 mile range, but
45 they say.
That would probably cover 50% of my road trips.
For most people, that's probably an entire, like, maybe not in the US, but here in Europe, entire week's worth of traveling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because they go like a mile that way, 2 miles that way, a mile that way.
Yeah.
And I mean, who this is for, it would not be for me. It would not be for most people. But if, let's just say you're in one of those Florida retirement communities where they're already driving that UTV, this, going to the local, restaurant or your what do you call it? Community center, on low speed roads. This is perfect.
Yeah,
it's basically a luxury golf cart, right?
It is. Yeah, but I'm gonna disagree with one thing in the article. They say it's not for, it's more, they call it the Birkin bag of golf carts than a useful commuter. I disagree. I know a lot of people, and I think more people than like you would realize could do that, right? Because they're going to work alone. Work is, I'd say, 10 miles away, which is probably far. Stuck in traffic most of the time, where electric cars are anyway better, and like you can go there and back and like have a cheap car for that. And I know people that do that, right? Like they literally bought old used smart cars because they were like they're cheap, they're dirt cheap to have, they're dirt cheap to maintain, and I'm literally just going to work and back with that. I don't need a big car for that, and it's like, why waste money?
I used to have a neighbor, he's since passed away, Andrew, and he had a smart car, and which is tiny, and he was a pretty big guy, but so you'd see Andrew cruising down the road in the smart car, and then I said, Andrew, what, you can't really carry anything in that car, and he says, well, I got a trailer, so when he'd go to the grocery store, he had modified this little trailer, and you'd see Andrew with the smart car at the trailer with groceries in the back.
Exactly. No, but I mean, it's also, let's be honest, like most of the time when you're going to work, you're not carrying anything. Maybe your bag, but like that can fit next to you. That's not a problem.
No, I could have commuted in a car like that.
Yeah.
Yep. So now is time for our final discussion of the day, our hang jury segment. Earlier this year, a Brown University professor did something he'd never done in his 34 years of teaching. He gave his class a take-home exam. He did it out of compassion. And, you know, there had just been, unfortunately, some campus violence at Brown University. His students were traumatized, and he wanted to cut them some slack. Well, just under half of the students, 40 of 86, scored a perfect 100. The class average was 96, and previous years, you know, no one had ever gone above 80, and this exam was harder. And yeah, let's face it, this is Brown. It's freaking Ivy League. These are the best of the best, and they still make it hard.
Yes.
You know, then he made the final in person. Well, the average collapsed to 48. 27 students dropped the course. 22 of them had scored perfect 100s on the take-home test. The professor went public with his quote, and I love this, "We cannot choose to become idiots." Now the obvious reaction is those students cheated. End the story. Thank you, OpenAI. But here's the uncomfortable counter. Nearly half of Harvard and Princeton seniors admit to doing the same thing. When it's that widespread, especially in the Ivy League, is this really a student character problem? Or has higher education just completely failed to adapt to a world where AI exists? Or both? Well, that is your hang jury, Patrice and Tom. Where do you land?
I love this one. I mean, I also picked it. It's an interesting question, right? Because on one hand, you can say, well, I mean, it's cheating, right? It's clear. You're supposed to learn something and not use AI. But on the other hand, the reality is we're living in a world where AI is part of our job, and it's part of what we need to learn how to use. And it's simply a reality that we have it. So maybe, and I'm strongly leaning on that side, maybe the way we've been doing things in the past is outdated. Doesn't mean that we now replace everything with AI and say we don't need anything anymore, we don't need to learn anything anymore. I think that's the wrong approach. But to say, how can we ensure that we learn the right things in a world where AI exists?
Yeah.
I think I agree with that take. I think education will have to adapt in some way. You know, it's not unlike when calculators were introduced.
Yeah.
cheap calculators. Which I think
they considered them cheating back then too.
Yeah, yes. Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think people are going to have to learn how to use new technology like AI. It'll take some time.
Mm-hmm.
They will also maybe have to ramp up how they sort of replace the critical thinking that can get lost in AI or introduce mm-hmm. that into how to use AI.
Yeah.
That's my biggest concern. Using AI to me is fine. It's a tool. Use a tool.
Yep.
But if using that tool prevents students from learning critical thinking, I think that's the problem.
Yeah.
Because the point of an exam at school or a class at school is not to become an expert on that subject purely.
Yeah.
It's also to learn how to learn and learn how to do critical thinking and research and all those kinds of things.
Yeah.
I mean, yes and no. I think the part of education that was, in my opinion, already broken because we have the internet was you need to have this knowledge. I mean, ever since we've had libraries, right. Ever since we've had the internet or computers even, like, I mean, we've had access to knowledge that was easier even with computers without the internet. Like, we had CDs that you could just get anything you wanted. What was it called? Microsoft Encarta, I think, for example.
Encarta, yeah.
So I think that part of you need to learn all of that knowledge and you need to memorize everything, I think, was already broken. It's just more broken now. But you're right. The critical thinking and the using the tool and comparing sources and whatever, which, as I said, we had to learn for the internet. I had to learn that when I grew up, right? How to use the sources I get from the internet and what to trust and what not to trust, right? Can I trust Wikipedia all the time? Back in the day, at first it was like, Wikipedia is not a source, you cannot use it. That changed.
Yeah.
That changed. But what didn't change was, you can use it as a source, but you have to, well, one, corroborate it maybe, and two, question it as well and say, like, where did Wikipedia get the information from and is it correct? Right? It's the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, you know, it's like everything else. It's not that different from the past. It's just moving much faster and it's
much
more complex. Because even when I was a kid, you know, you had to differentiate using critical thinking, the difference between an article in the National Enquirer and an article in the New York Times.
True.
I mean, that's an extreme example.
Mm-hmm.
But also, you had to understand, you know, this is, you know, this city's newspaper, every big city had three or four newspapers. This one is a little bit liberal leaning. This one is a little bit conservative leaning. This one is, you know, run by whatever, a religious group or something, you know, so you just, it doesn't mean they were good or bad. It's just that you had to understand.
Yeah.
Do a little bit of critical thinking of your source. Yeah.
Yeah. This one is run by students. Now. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
You're right. It's much harder these days and it's so much easier to just relinquish the thinking and the doing to an AI and simply say, go do it.
Yeah. And I think the thing about using AI is, if I just give a prompt, say, write a paper about the history of William Shakespeare.
Yeah. It will do
useless.
It.
You're not going to learn anything. Yeah.
No, but it will
but
do
if
it.
It's more of a, yeah, it'll do it. But if it's more of a, you know, a companion or tool and
yeah.
you know, that's a good thing. You just need to teach students how to do that.
Yes. I think we have
two things at play that are diametrically opposed. You know, college age adults are in a point of their life where they can adapt rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
However, education adapts very slowly.
Yes.
Case in point, when I was in high school, our computer class still had dual disk drive DOS machines in the late 90s.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's always been this discussion whether we are teaching for today or we teaching for 10 to 15 years ago. Yeah. And I think that has to be revisited and maybe not worry as much what the subject matter is, as how to get to the subject matter in the modern day. because I do not remember a lick of the how many history classes I had. However, I do remember how to retrieve that information should I ever need it again.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. The 7 times I had to learn the same history over and over and over, I don't remember any of it. It's true. I think, I mean, it's also in this case, I think it was very naive of that professor to think they would do that. Because there's two things. Ben, you mentioned it's an Ivy League school, right? So that doesn't just mean, oh, this is very good. No, it means there's a lot of pressure. A lot of pressure to perform. Yeah. It's very competitive, whatever. And the students are probably overwhelmed half of the time, I would imagine. I mean, I was even back in the day, and I wasn't in an Ivy League school. Sometimes there were days where I was completely overwhelmed with all the things I had to do, and like not a lot of time. Mm-hmm. Plus, you're still very young. You probably also want to have some fun. You want to relax a little bit and like enjoy also student life a little bit. And I'm going to be honest. I think I would have done the same thing. I might have maybe... I might have probably done hopefully some work and like improved it and edited what the AI had written, but I would have 100% used AI to do it. I mean, I'm gonna be honest, the script that we did today, that was AI with little augmentation from me. Right? So
and a little vibing for me.
Exactly. I mean, it's also the other part, right? This is not a script that you read, this is a script that you interpret basically, and you put in your own words and your own way.
Well, and I'm sure you didn't say, "Hey, Google AI, write me an intro and walk away," right?
No, there were like 8-10 different iterations until it was what I wanted and like how I phrased it. And even then, after that, I edited some. So that's what I'm saying. But I would have used AI.
Yeah.
I heard the guy from I think the guy from Grammarly talk about their use of AI and kind of differentiate between, you know, sort of the push button, just give me what I want kind of use of AI versus how to use it as a tool and a companion, a writing tool, more like an editor. You know?
Yeah. A lot of people are seeing that with vibe coding these days. Like we have on InSpace, like there's a lot of people that are doing vibe coding, and there is a difference between the people that, and it's not a judgment. There's a difference between the people that have a technical development background and the people who don't. And it's not that you can't learn it. You totally can, and they can get as good. But you see the difference because the understanding of what's going on and the capability of getting the AI to do the thing you want in a somewhat efficient manner as well is simply not there. It's different. It's that people can 100% learn that. It just takes time. It's not free.
Yeah.
You can't just, what people think always like with vibe coding and AI and whatever, it's like, okay, anybody from the street, I can give them an AI and say, and they can be like whatever, nuclear physicist. No, it's not how it works.
No, I agree.
Also, okay. CEOs so that are saying that.
So here's the question for this poor Brown professor, given the situation that he was dealing with the, you know, the trauma that was going on at Brown.
Yeah.
My guess is we probably think he should have thought about a completely different way to do his final exam somehow.
Yes. Well, or instead of complaining about it after, I mean, he wanted to cut them some slack. So cut them some slack.
Pass
them all. Yeah. Be like, okay, hey, good for you. You did it in a way that, I mean, you fulfilled the requirements that I set out before.
That's true.
Whether you learned something or not, and that was what a lot of my professors said. It's like, whether you learned something or not is your responsibility at the end. You're an adult. You might be a young adult, but you're an adult. If you want to do the minimal effort and to get a grade or get a passable grade and learn absolutely nothing, then that's your problem, because that's going to come back and bite you in the future.
Yeah.
Yeah. In your first job, probably it'll come back and bite you.
Yeah. So same thing here. If they want to do that, and as I said, they did fulfill, I mean, apparently because they were perfect hundreds, they did fulfill the requirements.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah.
So I mean, I disagree with him. I think, I mean, what was he expecting? And to be honest, he shouldn't even have done the in-person exam and be like, well, good for you. Yeah. I wanted to give you an out and you took an out and hey, okay, good for you.
Which begs the question, should this professor have learned something?
I hope he did.
Right. It's more about him learning something than the students, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, both.
I mean, but to be fair to the professor, you know, he was faced with a pretty tough situation.
Yeah.
No, but going to the students and having an honest discussion about that and saying, okay, I mean, good for you. You got your hundreds. But have you thought about that? That would have been the right way.
Okay, let's do some drops.
Drop, drop, drop.
Okay, Patrice, I want to talk about this ubiquity iPhone Pro
Max. The iPhone Pro Max 16. Yeah, it's a 16 Pro Max, right? No, it's a Switch. So I cannot show it to you because it's sitting...
Nintendo in Switch?
No.
It's switching? It's
network Switch. It's switching behind me. It is, to be absolutely fair, completely oversized for what I needed because I didn't need 16 ports, but the smaller ones were basically more or less the same price for what I needed. So it was like, I might as well just take the big one.
And there's PoE too.
Yeah, it has four PoE ports. It has this is not the PoE version. Sorry, this is not the PoE version, but there is a PoE version if you want it. This has four 2.5 gigabit ports and then 12 gigabit ports. If you need that. For me, the important thing was it has two 10 gigabit SFP plus ports, so for fiber connections, because as I've mentioned last week, I'm wiring my entire house with fiber. So that was the important thing. the fiber connections are, I mean, they're actually quite cheap these days. The cables are not that expensive anymore, and they're super thin and super light, so it's easy to get them everywhere. That was basically the solution. It's not a cheap switch because it has 60 ports, 270 euros in this case, or $320 with taxes here. But it is, I mean, it's ubiquity. It is super solid. It is like, it got everything you needed. So yeah. Power input is USB-C. You can even hook it up to uninterruptible power supply and all that. You know, ubiquity equipment, which is quite good. So that's my cool thing.
That's pretty cool. Patrice, just for comparison, in my house, I have two switches. Each of them has two ports, and I think I paid $20.
Yeah, for sure. No, as I said, I mean, I do have quite some stuff in here, like my office. So there is some, and I need more than two ports here. I had a four-port switch, and it was before, and it was too small. So, as I said, for me, the important thing was optical.
Optical is cool. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, so the uplink is optical, and then my MacBook and whatever here are 2.5 gigabits, which is totally fine, my server. It's a good switch.
Yeah, I have Cat 6e laying all over the floor here, so I eventually have to do a little bit of...
You have cats lying on your floor? Network. You have cats on your floor?
One of the four is right in front of is behind my computer now, laying on my OWC Thunderbolt 5 hub. Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing with fiber. Like, this is two fibers. Like, they're with like a lot of protection or whatever. They're really, really small and thin. Yeah. This can do, I think, even 100 gigabit if you wanted to.
Holy cow.
Yes. And you know, Patrice, the entire network is colored pink.
Yes. Of course. Magenta. It's not pink. It's magenta. Yes.
So we are. So Patrice's network brought to you by T-Mobile.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I'm not going to lie. The whole thing was a little bit more expensive. But it's also because I need a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
So next week I'll have another part of that, because there's one more part that you need.
It's like the gift that keeps on giving.
Yes.
Tom, what is this Watch Duty app?
Okay.
Are we going to be standing watch like we're in the military?
Yeah. Watch, that is true. Watch Duty. So it refers to people like fire watchers, you know, those guys that sit up on those big towers and look over forests for fires, which is a job I've always thought about trying for a week. What would that be like? I know, but what would it, anyway. So the app is Watch Duty, and it's that time of year, depending on where you live in the Northern Hemisphere. If you ever have to deal with wildfires, Watch Duty is a great app. And it's basically, you know, a map that shows you all the incidents, wherever you want to look, and it gives you good information about the incidents. How big is it? How much containment do they have? All that kind of stuff. And I started using this when we had a really bad fire season here in California 3-4 years ago. And I basically, I download it every sort of March or April, and I keep it on my phone until like October, November. And I also use it for trips because, you know, in America, we drive everywhere and we drive a long way. And I'm getting ready to make another trip up to the state of Washington. It's about a total of about 12 hours driving. And it's really useful to know where the wildfires are, avoid them. You know, just for convenience, but also smoke, and also just to stay the hell out of the area if there's a fire and let people do their job, you know. So Watch Duty, it's a very useful app if you live in the kind of area that I live in.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think since the LA wildfires, Watch Duty is quite a known app, I think.
Yeah, it got really popular during the LA fires, right?
Yeah, I mean, just good. I mean, you kind of need something like that. Very cool. Yeah, I think Europe will be next because it's getting so hot here that everything is burning now.
Yeah, you might want it.
Oh, it feels like it's burning right now.
Yeah, it is. It actually is.
So
Ben, what about you?
Yes, my drop is semi-related to my story. It is a YouTube channel titled E-Bike School. That was the initial focus of the channel, but it has become so much more. A number of years ago, the presenter went out and bought a electric Chinese pickup truck to use as basic. His family owns some land, and he bought this truck as basically like, you know, something to use around the farm to see how it does. Well, that led him on a completely different rabbit hole. He now has an electric boat for his pond, an electric jet boat.
Okay.
Electric tractor, electric excavator. Like, this guy has bought pretty much every piece of electric Chinese stuff he can get shipped over here.
Oh my God.
And it is pretty entertaining to see all this electric equipment just doing jobs that, I mean, you can't get. None of this stuff is road legal.
Of course.
But it is. It just kind of offering that perspective and seeing this go from an e-bike channel to, which was something is really not in my cup of tea, to what it has become now is pretty awesome.
I like the videos titled DIY lithium battery spot welding.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
I'd like to see what that one is about.
Well, yeah, that's the other thing. You know, they come a certain way, but he has further modified his equipment to better meet his needs.
Yeah, it's like in the old days when we used to take a regular car and make a hot rod out of it. Right?
Yeah.
Now it's electric vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
Hot rodding his electric tractor.
Right. That's cool.
It has so many options.
Yeah. And what's really hilarious is like some of the stuff he has to figure out how to get it out of the shipping package.
Okay.
Like he has to unwell, he's like, that's like cut up the shipping packet to get it out. It's very entertaining and it's worth watching.
Yeah. Good Trump. Like it.
So, unfortunately, that means it is time to say goodbye for this week. Tom, since this is your first time and we have popped your tech hangout cherry, tell us where we can find you.
Oh, my God.
People can find me on Mastodon. I am tomf@sfba.social. And I had a great time on my first Tech Hangout episode. Thanks, everybody.
Did you say Mastodon?
Mastodon.
That'd be awesome.
Mastodon?
Mastodon.
That would be a good server for all the
math. Yeah, math. There's probably a really one, but yeah.
I'm literally now picturing an ancient elephant scribbling on a chalkboard.
Yes, of course.
Doing calculus. Yeah.
Yep.
Yes.
And no calculator, no AI.
So was the abacus also considered a cheat?
Yeah, I think at some point was. It probably was.
Yeah. Socrates is a math teacher.
Right.
Speaking of Europeans, Therese, where can we find you?
Okay, that was a transition. I'm here every week on the Tech Hangout. Everything I'm doing, social media links, podcasts, projects, cool things, the whole list of cool things that I've not ever picked, but since 2019, I think, late 2019. All of that is on my website, thepatrice.com. And then Jeff Gamet and I have Retro Rewatch. We rewatch retro TV shows and then we talk about it. We are right now still in season 4 of Stargate SG-1, but barely. We are, I think, Entity we posted last week. So we are closing in on the end of the season. The next one will be Double Jeopardy, which is unofficially the beginning of the four-part arc that spans between season 4 and season 5 of Stargate SG-1. So look forward to that.
As you should. So, or as Teal could say, indeed.
Indeed. No, right now he's just saying Wikipedia things like, oh, this world here is well known for blah 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 blah, like
the tour guide.
Yeah, he's we call it Tilk Wiki. It's the only thing he gets to say other than stand around and say nothing. Ben, how about you?
And well, you can find me at Ben Rathig on your social media of choice. I'm on pretty much all of them, even the ones I have forgot. Like, what was that whale one?
The whale one. The Heilzeit, you mean?
No, the whale social network. It was one of the
Blue Sky
clones.
Blue Sky. I think that's the one, right?
No, it was a rival Blue Sky, but never mind. You can find my writing. Chuck was real into it. My writings and ravings can be found at RathigTech.com if I ever start writing again, and you can find me here in the panel and in the host seat on the Tech Hangout. We'll see you same tech time, same tech channel next week. Thank you to our panel, Patrice and Tom. We'll see you tomorrow.
He'll see you tomorrow.
Nobody told me about tomorrow. Saturday. I'm not working Saturday.
No, there's no tomorrow.
I am. Cut it.